My condition was ill. I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... So, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown
shining in. Greg Pappas on the board here. He turned me on. It's always good when you're talking. S&P Futures up 4, NASDAQ Futures up 16. Actually, Greg, I cannot hear myself through there, so you got to open something up over there. Not sure what he doesn't have on, but something's not on.
Sound good to me, Chief.
But it's not coming back to me. To me. There you go. My own voice is not coming back to me. It's like it's supposed to.
That might be
on your computer. He'll figure it out. Do we have Kevin?
You do. Good morning. And that is nice news to know that Greg turned you on.
Well, he's about to. I still can't hear any feedback through my own headphones when I'm talking. But it's a good thing I can hear myself talk anyway. You know, it's...
Well, I hope you guys will be happy together.
Yeah, it's, you know, he's doing okay. He, you know, he's covering for a little Matt who's going to New Orleans today. I'm not so sure why, well, they're going... The Jazz Fest is, Jazz Fest is 2 weeks down there, I guess, and they're going for the second week. And, so they, They're going through the second week, so he says, you're going to see the dead, who's dead, everybody. You're going to see Santana, who actually is playing in Ravinia this summer, two nights in a row.
Hey, the old man can still play.
Yeah, yeah. He's 74-ish.
Something 75-ish, like that.
Yeah. Did you see him in Notre Dame? I did.
No, I think that was before I got there. I think only you elders.
Might have been my freshman year, actually.
Yeah, that.
Then I saw him again at, I'm dating myself, International Amphitheater. I saw him again.
I saw the Rolling Stones at the International Amphitheater.
Wow.
It's one of the best shows I have ever seen. It was the Exile on Main Street tour. Which I think is their best album. So it was good from that, in that regard. But the opening act for the show was Stevie Wonder.
Really? Well, the opening act for Carlos Santana was Bo Diddley.
Well, that would be pretty darn good, too. Yeah. I've seen Bo Diddley live, too. He's really good.
Actually, you know what, I'm not so sure.
He was really good. Not anymore.
You know what, I'm not so sure he, come to think of it. No, I saw two concerts. I saw Santana and Creedence. He opened for one of them. I'm not sure which one it was. It might have been Creedence he opened for. Those are the two groups I saw there. It was a smaller, I won't say it was acoustically spectacular place, but it was smaller venue.
Smelled like dead carcasses.
Yeah, no, it was.
It was by the Stockyards.
Yeah, for those who don't remember, it was the amphitheater of the Union Stockyards, and they had a large exhibition hall there. As a matter of fact, the International Auto Show, or the Chicago Auto Show, was there every year before McCormick Place was built, right? I went to one there. God, my grandfather took me. I had to be like 6 or 7. So that'd be like 1958 or something. And, of course, I got lost, but he found me. It was like, okay, he found me. I think he was going to go home without me. But
he tried to duck you, but it didn't work out. Huh?
Well, you know what? I, of course, was in a panic looking for him. I still remember. All of a sudden, there he was. He goes, I knew you were in a panic running around, so I just stayed in one spot, figured you'd come by, and sure enough, you did.
So, anyway. Well, and so here's the hot tip for young parents. I hope Matt Weber's listening. Is when you're young and gets old enough to go to you with stuff, but not quite old enough that you want to do it, the first thing you do is you hand them a ticket. If it's a ball game or something like that, you make sure he has his ticket stub, and you go in the place and you point out the usher, and you say, if you get lost, if we get separated, you go up to the guy in that yellow coat or whatever they're wearing, and you say, take me to this seat. I'll be there.
I thought you were going to really date yourself and say, go up to the Andy Frame guy.
Go up to the Andy Frame usher. Yeah, that would work. But part two of that, of course, is what if you get separated on the way out? And so you always have to pick the gate that you need to meet at when you're going out. Now, I remember, we used to do that with my son. I remember going back to 1993, it was really more, at that point, he was old enough. It wasn't an issue. But we went to the Notre Dame-Florida State game, and that was the one where the Irish were number one. They did the impossible. Nobody thought they'd beat Florida State, and they did. And so the Irish were undefeated. And I remember my son looking at me as the fans started to storm the field, and he looked at me, and he said, whatever gate it was, gate 10, right? Right, okay. And down, and then he made a beeline for the field.
God. He
was probably about a high school freshman at that point.
Well, speaking of being the parent, so Matt's little one, she's just, little Neve is just starting to walk. Okay, as of like this
trouble.
Room. Yeah, so the interesting
it's
part.
It's all over now.
The best part is Venkman, the pooch. He thinks there's something wrong, and she's like trying to escape. So the minute she gets up, he runs in front of her and starts licking her face, and she falls back down because he doesn't think she should be running around where she's not supposed to be.
Right, she crawls. She doesn't run.
Yeah, well, it's I like the part where they get up on, they make like their first step, and 3 days later they're carrying stuff around, and you're wondering how the hell they did that in like 3 days, but they learn pretty quick. Hey, there's a issue here. I don't know how this works here necessarily. But you and Carl are my experts. What can I say? What do you make of this dark web thing they did yesterday, where they went on the dark web and supposedly drugs, guns, and crypto seized, 280 arrested, an unprecedented dark web crackdown. How do you seize people's crypto? I guess I got a brain fart, brain block, something about this crypto and how it's supposed to be nobody can get at it, and yet people can get at it somehow. I mean, it's
well, first of all, the whole idea that that there's this extra anonymity in cryptocurrencies, that's not true. That's not how blockchain works. So you might be able to keep your ownership of a cryptocurrency wallet. So let me back up the train a little bit more. You get on a cryptocurrency platform. You create an account, basically. That's what your wallet is. It's an account. And so when you purchase cryptocurrency, purchase Bitcoin, for example, it goes into your wallet. And then when you spend it, it comes out of your wallet. And so you might be able to disguise your ownership of the wallet. And I'm not on any of the exchanges, so you might have talked to somebody. You might want to get like when Matt Weber's back, because I know he's done some stuff with crypto. You might want to get the real mechanics of it. But this is the basics: is that you have this wallet. Now, the thing about blockchain is that it's totally traceable. It's built to be that way. And so what does that mean? It means that every time you conduct a transaction, you just add to the block, which is thus the name blockchain. You add to the history. You don't exchange it. You don't cover up one history for the other. Nothing like that happens. It is, next owner, next owner, next owner, all identified by the wallet. So you could always trace a transaction. You can always trace the money right to the point where it gets to the cryptocurrency wallet. At that point, if the whoever owns the wallet is able to convert it into real money, I prefer that term now that I think about it, it gets converted into real money. And what that means is you empty the wallet and convert it into dollars. Now, you have to have somebody who is willing to do that for you, so you have to have a buyer on the other side, and so that becomes part of the equation. And to that extent, it looks sort of like a market. You know, you can trade it for cash as long as you have somebody who's willing to pay you the cash.
So if the system ever went down, it would still be it would be somebody all of a sudden it's not convertible and you just can't get it out of there because nobody will buy it from you, basically.
Correct.
Which, for some of the other cryptocurrencies, that's kind of what's happened, right?
Well, yeah. So go back and consider like the Colonial Pipeline hack. Remember that was a ransomware attack?
Yeah.
And they wound up paying the ransom. They got almost all of it back because the people who were who were behind the attack could not empty their cryptocurrency wallet fast enough, and so the feds got in and they managed to claw that all back, and that that worked out pretty well. But this is one of the things about, and you and I, if we were to go set up a wallet, we'd do it, I'd have mine in the name, and it'd be Kevin O'Neill's cryptocurrency wallet, however we wanted to identify it. I wouldn't go in as Crazy Man 22 or something like that.
I'd go in as Greg Pappas.
You could do that.
Yeah,
you could do that. But then you'd have a giant target on your back the whole time.
That's true. Everybody'd be all over me.
Everybody'd be all over you. Yep. But so you sort of get the idea. That's how it works.
I'm gonna start paying in crypto at his bar. You do that,
there's
Greg?
A 20% markup, actually.
So what? I mean, you're never going to get it.
Yeah.
Make it a 40% markup.
20% markup, the value can swing 20% in a day.
Yeah, it was like the guy in Casablanca. Doesn't matter. He sends me the bill, I tear up the bill,
So that's sort of the long-winded, okay, so now what's going on? Well, when they do a raid, they're trying to get their hands on the contents of the wallet.
Okay. So, it says
so
here
that's how they're trying to confiscate the money.
It says they arrested 288 suspects and seized tens of millions of dollars worth of crypto in a globe-spanning drug enforcement operation. Do you know anybody who's ever been on the dark web?
I don't personally, but the dark web. Probably the easiest way to think of the dark web is you could almost go back to the early days of the internet. You have the web addresses, www.stocksandjocks.net. That goes into the, for lack of a better analogy, the phone directory of the internet. And when you put that into the directory, you associate that with an IP address. So, it'll be 147.22.66.22, something like that, and that's the address of the server where your website resides. In the dark web, you avoid that directory. Only people who know your IP address can get to you.
But you need all the numbers of the IP address to get there.
Yeah. It's sort of think of it like this. Here's another way to think of it. You have a contacts list in your phone nowadays.
Right.
Remember when we were young, you had to know that you either had to know the phone numbers of everybody that you called, or you had to look them up in the phone book,
or call directory assistance.
Can't or call anymore. Directory assistance until they started charging for that, which was actually a smart move. So, you would have all of that going on. Now, nowadays, how many phone numbers do you know?
I don't know any. That's why yesterday I bought myself a backup phone, just so I can run a backup phone list.
Yeah, so you don't know any of them anymore because we just have a contacts list. Well, on the dark web, you have to know all the phone numbers.
And you have
they
to...
They aren't in your contacts list. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
So that gives you the opportunity that only people who are directed there, and this is why you have investigators are constantly in there trying to cruise around, find IP addresses, find out what's going on there. It is all spy versus spy stuff.
Well, I know where Matty used to work. I think he's got a new job. We're talking about Matt Weber. They were an internet security firm essentially, and if you were Sirius, Greg, if every time you guys got a credit card transaction, you ran over to the old copper phone line and had the machine that was hooked into the copper phone line. Remember those things? I don't know if you remember those, but they had one at Tripoli up until like a year ago. And so you'd get the little tiny receipt from your credit card. Well, those things, according to Matty, were virtually idiot-proof. I mean, nobody, you couldn't hack in because you just went right on the copper line to wherever the hell it was supposed to go. But now once you started to have your people's credit cards like on your computers, like you do over at Sirius, where you just tap in the credit card into the computer, all of a sudden now you need a lot of security protocol because people can hack into that computer and steal people's credit cards that are running through buying drinks or dinner at your place. And so now there's a big, I mean, that's what they did. But they also would do an awful lot of, like Kevin's talking about, where they would do a lot of alleged research, where if somebody had a, because their biggest clients are like American Express, you know, people like that. They're huge clients. And so what they would do is they try and figure out, if they found something, say it was Joe's off-brand ammunition or something, something that they would, cause these were other clients they had, they would actually pop through like a 5-hour charge into Joe's grenades or something, and try and figure out where the $5 landed, and it might end up at Mrs. Pappas's flower store. It was totally allegedly legit. What they would do is a lot of times where you think you're charging something, it's actually popping up someplace. I'll use the term legit. So if Kevin's selling
front for money laundering.
Yeah, well, magazine. If he's selling 12-shot magazines when it's in a state where only 10 are legal or something, probably it's going to go. The money's not going to go to Joe's 12-shot magazine. It's going to go to...
No, it's going to go to Los Pollos Hermanos.
Yeah, or someplace like that. And so they would actually make all these little charges all over the place just to see where they went. Like Kevin says, the intrigue on the other side is almost as interesting as the intrigue on the dark side.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the security firms, they do all kinds of stuff. So they're trying to keep you clean and out of the... out of the illegitimate transaction world. They're also trying to keep, trying to hack into your systems on your behalf and see, find your vulnerabilities. It's the whole cybersecurity field is really, really interesting. And if I were starting a career now, and especially if I didn't want to get into management, because there's all the associated headaches with that. Cybersecurity would be an interesting place to work.
Kevin, I want to shift gears a little bit because obviously today is the biggest Fed announcement ever. Depending on who you talk to, you have the congressmen, mostly Democrats, have sent some big letter to Powell pleading with him not to raise rates, and let's put it this way. All the way through this grand experiment over the last really 10 years, ever since Greenspan went down to 1%, that was more than 10 years ago, and we have this back and forth on these interest things, and really the interest rates have been artificially low surely since 2008, maybe even since 2000, but certainly 2008. And you get to the point where you lose track of your... of any kind of principle you might have had, any kind of monetary or economic principle. And I've, for God, as long as I'm on this show and the shows I was on before with Dr. J, all I've said was, this is insane because it's unworkable. The idea that interest rates should be zero. And when I go from this, I've said this a zillion times, and you know what? So hopefully I'll say it another zillion times. The cost of money is a real factor of production. Now, I'm not going to go economic crazy on everybody here, but a factory of production is something you need to produce widgets, whatever it is. And when I say that, a guy like Greg Pappas, an entrepreneurial young man, might say, I need a widget factory. Okay, so what do I need? Well, I need, well, I sure as hell need a roof, so I better get some steel. I better get something else I need for the roof. And, oh, by the way, I need some concrete because I'm having these big machines sitting on something. They can't be just sinking into the sand. All this stuff you need to put this factory together. One of the things you need is money. And in this world, just think of it, whether it's a savings loan, whatever it is, the people who have the money have earned it. Okay, whatever they did, maybe they inherited it, maybe they earned it, whatever it is, they've got the money, and usually the person with the incredible idea for the new widget factory is probably not the same person who just happens to have the money. So what is he going to do, he or she? They're going to say, Joe, you've got the dough, or what is it?
You got the money, I got the time.
Yeah, you got the money, I got the time. And Joe's going to say, well, what do I get out of it? Well, you're going to pay for the use of somebody else's capital, just like you do if it's concrete, if like it's steel or whatever. And to take for a period of 12 or 15 years to blow so much cash into the system where you totally upset this dynamic to where people don't get paid for you giving them their money, which is insane. And, oh, by the way, you drop some inflation on top of that so their money degrades in value every single year. Kevin, this is an abomination. From day one, it's been an economic abomination. It can't happen. Over now, if it's a short-term thing, if there's a war, if there's something, everybody takes one for the team. I mean, every Americans are good at that. I'd be happy to, not for 15 years, not to where it becomes normal to a lot of young people go, why should I ever get any money for my money? What are you talking about? Some mope's using your dough for free. What's the matter with you? You almost want to get out, what was it, the Aquavelva commercial, the cold slap in the face.
Cold slap in the face, yeah.
Yeah. And now, all of a sudden, we're getting back to somewhat normalcy. And one of the biggest problems these banks are having is they've got themselves set up somehow. One of them is idiotically buying bonds, longer-term bonds, at some ridiculous rate, okay? But it's also, I don't think they have any loans anymore, Kevin, that are decent. Maybe they lent too much money to Amazon and these other people and not enough to Joe the Plumber, who's actually still paying some interest. The biggest issue I see now is all of a sudden these guys need to pay on some of these deposits to retain them, and they can't do it. And people are pulling their money out and going to the Treasury like we do every week for clients here and go to the auction, or they're going to money markets, or they're going to some smaller banks that are paying them. They're appalled they actually have to pay somebody for their dough. For God's sake, Kevin, what is the matter with them? I mean, how did we get so mentally screwed up in this thing? So now we're going back to somewhere near normal, and the Congress people go, wait a minute, we're gonna have to pay interest now again for stuff? What about the poor people who gave people money for 12 years and got nothing for it? I mean, it's astounding how we've turned around on this to where, you know, I guess if every time I walk from the parking lot to the office, if somebody quicker than me snuck out and slapped me on the back of the head, and it happened every single day for 12 years, I guess it would be considered normal at some point, but it's still not right. It still hurts when a guy smacks me on the back of the head. I mean, why is any kind of reversion to anything normal here such an upsetting thing? But it is, because people did this. Why the federal government was ever able to sell crap at 1% for 10 years, and why people bought it. You know, and Greg and I have had, you know, several discussions on this where he says, these people were dumb enough. Well, he's right there. He can talk for himself. But these people are dumb enough to not hedge it. And I said, Greg, we're talking about people that are forced to buy this stuff, insurance companies, whatever.
You're not forced to buy just one instrument. They could have done, you know, 3-month, 90-day paper. They could do a whole bunch of stuff.
I get it.
Lazy.
But I'm saying, but Greg, you as you mature, one of these days you're going to end up on a board, because Greg's a very bright man. One of these days you're going to end up on the board of an insurance company, or maybe you're the guy doing the buying, and they're going to go, hey, buddy, we've taken your advice, and we're buying these 90-day T-bills at zero. We're getting nothing.
Maybe they run out of patience after 2 years or 3 years.
Yeah, it's what happened, fine. I think. They all of a sudden they say, look, at least with the 10-year, we're getting 1.5%. I mean, now it's always interesting, Kevin, when you sort of argue with somebody and you agree with everything they say. Greg is absolutely right. These people should have been smarter. But what about the bumps in Europe that bought stuff at a negative interest rate? What do you suppose their stuff looks like? And what, that's another question, Kevin or Greg. Why haven't we heard any disasters from Europe? They should be way worse. Where'd they get it? -1.5%, Greg? Or was it -1? Something like that.
I think at the Milken Conference or wherever they were talking a couple of days ago, that was a big subject. The CEO of Apollo and not Jamie Dimon. Who was it? There was one other big figure who was talking about what are regional banks going to do now? You know, their commercial property loans might be underwater, as well as, you know, their whole business model. So what are they going to shift into to make money?
Well, I don't know.
Well, and let's go back on the business model for a minute, because everybody's business model in the banking industry is all tied into its ability to make loans.
Right.
And they all almost inevitably, they think they're going to do a lot more business than they do. So what happens? Well, I have non-earning assets. I've got to get something, I've got to do something with all that cash on deposit. That's the liability side, but I got to get it into some kind of an earning asset rather than just holding cash. So they go out on the securities markets and fill in the blanks for the loans that they can't make. So, okay, now we sit there and say, okay, how are we doing? How have we matched the securities and the maturities in a way that allows us to manage our interest rate risk? And the answer is they don't. And that's, that's where the banks break down, is they've just done such a poor job. They haven't been left with a lot of choices. I would agree with that. This is so built into the banking system at this point in such a dysfunctional way that digging out of the hole is going to be a pain. Now, what happens in the meantime? Well, we just transfer all the wealth to the big banks. We'll just go keep selling them to JPM or whoever. So we are, like everything else that we've done in recent years, we are in the midst of yet another wealth transfer from the littler guys to the big guys.
It always seems to work out. And in fact, though, I bet if you look at percentage-wise, they're just as much trouble, because they all need loans.
That's step two, Tom, is when you consolidate this all into the big guys. Now, there will always be the local banks. To the extent that at least in rural America, not so much in the cities, but I think there's a longer life for the locals than there is for the regionals, and that's a good thing. But as you start to see all of these stressed out regional banks get bought up, what's going to happen? Well, we're going to now stress out all of the major money center banks, and then when we do, the government can take them over.
Well,
we have a government banking system.
But you've seen changes, Kevin, that shouldn't be there, and some of it, all these, again, if there is such a thing as a theme to the show, other than having smart people on here, it's that everything ties together. I mean, you look at banks. I'm going to say the regional banks, even some of your. The game for 10 years, which seems like forever, is to gather up all these assets, liabilities to the bank, gather up all these deposits, charge people if you can for any kind of account under $2,000 or something, charge the hell out of them, actually make it a negative interest rate type of environment. If they go to the wrong ATM, you charge them. Whatever it is, you make it as negative as you can. But basically, you're getting, I'll say, money for free. And you turn around and you give it to the Federal Reserve overnight, and they were paying 1% or 0.75 or 1.25%, which doesn't sound like a hell of a lot. But if you can take in, $10 billion of other people's money and make 1% on $10 billion, it starts to add up, right? It doesn't sound like much, but there was no – these people don't have loan managers anymore. or anything like that. I mean, for instance, and now you have, when you go in to get your car, if you buy a car or a used car or whatever, the banks have totally given up on that business. I'm going to say my first car loan was at First National Bank at Evergreen Park. They were in the car loan business. You would get your price from your dealer, and then you would say to the guy, what interest rate, if you had a half a brain, you'd say, by the way, what interest rate are you doing? And, well, I'm doing 7. I can get 6 at my bank. And I go to First National and say, here's the car I bought. Give them the title. They give you the money at 6, and you pay the dealer. It's the banks are totally out of that. I asked my personal banker over at Lakeside, Fanny. I said, Fanny, you guys even, like, do car loans? And she says, well, we would for you, but no. I guess nobody comes in for a car loan. The auto dealers have totally taken over that business. As a matter of fact, when Audrey...
Well, finance companies have, yeah. Although, again, if you go where I live, if you go in and, you know, in the F&I, they'll have some choices for you as to where the, you know, the dealer will have choices for where you want to take your loan. And some of those will be the local banks. And that's why I said, you get away from the major cities, and the banking world is somewhat different.
Well, but even so, I mean... Some of these places now, Audrey's good friends, well, a guy worked for her uncle years and years ago that she bought her car from recently. This is, talk about troubling. They now have a finance officer in the dealership for new cars and used cars, and they also got another guy for repairs. Does that make the hair stand up on the back of your neck or what?
Yeah, nobody can afford to pay for repairs. Nobody can afford to finance it.
And if in a period of repairs, a new this or that is like $2,000 and $3,000, which is really incredible. Greg, you want to take a short break here, bud?
Let's do it.
SP Futures up 10. Been in your ear for the last 10 minutes.
He hasn't. He's getting there. SP Futures up 10. Nasdaq Futures up 38. Because now he's got to do traffic, weather, and sports. We'll see how he does. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here.
We'll give Maddie a call after.
Right here. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. He's Matt. You're not Matt. You're Greg Pappas on the board. We got two Matts, Greg Pappas. Like, you know, you guys, it's not like you're all the same. It's just you're on the other side of the wall. I can't see you. So sometimes I'll I'll get the wrong person. Anyway, that's my future. 9:15. I just heard you there.
Yeah, we can put a window in and we can look at each other.
We have to do that.
So all
we
right.
We can flip each other off or something. S&P futures up 9. NASDAQ futures up 34. We got Dow futures up 34. We've got CYX down 219. Nothing really going crazy. We were down really huge yesterday. I mean, really bad. We're down like 75 points in the spoos. It came back probably a third of that and closed down 50-ish. We'll actually give the real number here. We're down 48 in the S&P. We're down 367 in the Dow. But we were down over 500 at one point. So those are big moves. Euro today, we've got the DAX up 131.8. We got the FTSE up 20.2, CAC around up 52.7. I think a lot of people think the Fed is going to either give us a one more and done, or give us the data dependent, or they're not going to do something. Or I think they're trying to lobby these guys a little bit. We'll see. The Nikkei up 34, call that flat. Hang Seng down 234, 1.2%, 19,699. With Shanghai is still closed from the other day, which is the. What do they got, a New Year going on over there or something? Not the New Year, but something's going on. But Shanghai has not traded since last Friday on the 28th. Bonds down 3 basis points, 3.41. Bonds had a huge move down on, Wednesday and Monday, and a huge move up yesterday, so almost back to the same spot. Very strange. The Bund unchanged, 224. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.42. We've got oil, which has been heading south, now is really south, down 219. 69.42, under $70. Your gas is still really high. The spread there is massive. The refinery spread is plus taxes is huge. Brent down 2.22, 73.09. Natural gas down 3 cents, 2.17. RBOB down 6 cents, 2.37. So if you're paying 4.50, that's over a $2 spread. Spread used to be like a buck. Now it's over two. That's way too high. We've got gold up $1.40, 2024. So way up in the under 2,000 a couple days ago. Silver over down 8 cents, 25.53. That's a little strange. Copper unchanged, 3.85. We've got Bitcoin. We'll get Bitcoin here in a second. I don't know what happened to my Bitcoin. Anyway, the U.S. dollar is down today. That's why we've got gold up. The pound's back over 110. I mean, the euro's back over 110, and the pound's back over 125. So the dollar's been back and forth here the last few days, but right back up to where it was. Bitcoin's down 173, 28,603. A lot of stuff there, Greg. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Sox, World Series bound.
Yeah, really. It's 641 in Chicago. 41 degrees with a high of 55. Mostly cloudy today. Phoenix, 67 degrees, headed to about 90. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from O'Hare. 31 minutes to the Jane Byrne interchange. Inbound Kennedy from O'Hare to Montrose, 18 minutes. Outbound Kennedy from the interchange to O'Hare is about 17 minutes. Inbound Eden, Deerfield to the interchange is 33 minutes. Outbound, 27 minutes. Inbound Ike from the Wolf to the interchange is 24 minutes. Outbound, probably 13 minutes. Inbound Ryan, 95th to the interchange, 15 minutes. Inbound Stevenson, 294 to Dan Ryan is 23 minutes. Inbound Bishop Ford, 290 or I-80 to 290 is 35 minutes. Sports, we got the NBA Heat lose to the Knicks. They are tied 1-1. Lakers and the Warriors. Lakers beat the Warriors. Lakers lead the series 1-0.
How long is Jimmy Buckets out?
I'll find out for you.
Yeah, because if he's not playing, the Knicks are going to win that series.
Well, yeah. That's, you got to have faith.
Yeah.
In the MLB, the Cubs lost at Washington 1-4. Their game tonight starts at 6:05, Stroman versus Irvin. White Sox beat the Twinkies 3-2 in extra innings. Lambert got the win. They start tonight at 6:10. And then Arizona lost at Texas 4-6. Burke with the win, McGuff with the loss, and they start today at 1:05. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Kevin, it's like I almost wish instead of going to grad school, I should have gone to Europe and just traveled around and smoked dope or something and whatever. Because
you can still do that.
I could still do that, yeah. Especially now.
I think you could do it without even studying much, too.
Yeah, well, I'm saying that it is so scary that the stuff that Milton Friedman talked about, one of them, he says you can't let inflation get going, because when it does, it's so uneven. First, it feels really good when it first starts, but it's also so uneven that the stuff that the people the people who are benefiting by it will essentially control the day and keep it going, and the people who are not benefiting by it are going to get hurt so bad, and then when you turn the bus around, they continue to get hurt again. So if you look at people on the 40% on a 0 to 100% bracket, those people got what, a total of $4,000 in the mail or something from COVID, if they had any kind of a retirement. And this doesn't make you rich. If you had $1 million, if you have no pension, no anything, and you got $1 million in the bank to live on, that $1 million is now worth $650 maybe after 3 years, and your paycheck, if you're still working, is maybe up in the 3 years, possibly 10-12%, possibly, and that's if you're doing good. And unless you're a minimum wage person at 8 and now you're 11, I guess the percentage rise is huge, but it's actually only $3 an hour. It's not squat, basically. So you've absolutely buried that group. And now when you go back the other way, Kevin, and try tightening everything, interest rates are going up. Of course, that group never benefited anybody, because Jay Powell and Janet Yellen, as they lowered these interest rates. I did a quick study from 2010 to 2022, or 2008, 2020 was when I did it. Credit card rates actually went up as these rates kept jamming down. So most people never benefited by... You did if you bought a house, but then again, you had to pay more for the house, so you could make the argument that you broke even there, maybe, because you had to pay more for the house because the rates were lower. This has been an absolute goat bleep towards anybody in the middle class or below, Kevin. And anybody who doesn't recognize that just isn't looking. I very seldom say anything like that, but
I think I'm going to save that as a sound clip.
Yeah, I mean,
there's your title for today's show: yeah. Absolute goat bleep.
Yeah, but I mean, anybody who doesn't see this happening and look back and say that's, and where this person was, where the 30% guy, the 40% guy, the 50% guy was, first of all, in 2008, surely in 2020 versus today, anybody who doesn't realize the carnage that has happened is just looking the other way. Or am I being too negative?
No, you're not being too negative, and please stop calling me Shirley.
Yes, please don't call me Shirley.
But the and the other part about inflation is it's really a game of whack-a-mole. It just keeps popping up in a different place time after time after time. And that's, why does it do that? Obviously, maybe not so obviously, but regardless, because one thing's going to affect the next. So you might be okay in one area, but now all of a sudden the shipping cost is up. So now that price has got to get adjusted. And as soon as you adjust that price, that's going to affect the price of something else. And so you're playing this giant game. And that's part of how it spins out of control like it does, is we're just sitting here trying to cope. If we could focus in on one area and say, well, this is the only part that's messed up, yeah, then you could probably come up with policies to deal with it. But at this point, it's just, it kind of rages from one place to the next. And even now, as we are starting to say, well, the rate of increase is slowing down, it might be in some areas, in some key areas. You know, fuel, we talked about fuel when last week, when the report came out last month, fuel was good. Guess what? Fuel's back up some, so that's gonna give it an increase. It probably is gonna show us an increase, although we may have to adjust that out of the equation. But you keep playing these games, and every time something changes, it's gonna cascade through, and it doesn't give anybody any relief.
No.
And that's where the big problem is we don't get any relief. And even now, as some of the politicians want to crow about saying, well, see, inflation's slowing. No, it's still you know, the price level is still higher than the average person, the average family can manage.
I gave, how's this for an example? This I can't believe I thought this one up the other night. I think I was in the, Tripoli, and one of the ladies in the neighborhood that once in a while was in there, she listens to the show once in a while and says, Tom, explain to me this inflation. Is it stopping or starting, or do we have it right now? And she goes, I have trouble understanding it. And I said, well, how about taking this as an example? Somebody who's, you know, 190 pounds that gains 10 pounds a year for 8 years, and all of a sudden cuts back on their chow, and now they're not gaining any more. Well, that's...
Yeah, you're still 280 pounds.
I said, you have no inflation. You're not gaining, but you're now... You're still a big fat soul. And she goes, now I get it.
Yeah. No. That's a great analogy. Yeah, yeah, I love it.
You're still a big fat soul.
I love it. I'm going to use it elsewhere.
What do you think, Greg? Was it?
Someone, I think you're fat phobic.
Was there this
yeah,
guy.
Go ahead. Fat shame the economy.
Yeah, well, I'm saying right now we have, no matter what, if these guys cut inflation now to zero, we've got this price level that people can't handle.
Yeah,
now,
and there are only two ways for people to be able to handle it. There, the, you know, the one way is prices start to roll back. Not bloody likely.
Plus, if they do, it's going to be so uneven, Kevin. It might cause more damage on the way up.
It's going to be just like it was on the way up. It would be on the way down, and yep. And it would be very much tied to, a recession, and a really severe recession. The other is for real wages to catch up, but that's not going to happen overnight. You know, that may happen eventually. Maybe we can see that, but that's a long-term process, because if that starts to happen in the short term, guess what it's going to fuel? More inflation.
Well, and when you have, I'm going to say, the out-and-out lying about the CPI. God, Kevin, every time I don't dig into these, but you hear them on the radio once in a while, and you listen to BBM because it's a news station, and you'll hear about some big contract where somebody, after a strike and after all those kinds of, you know, hurts where you didn't get paid during a strike and all this kind of stuff, you'll hear something where they got a 4-year contract with a 14% raise over the next 4 years. And I go, I almost slammed a car into a tree. I mean, I'm like, you did what? You better have some really good coal adjustment in that, or you just sentenced your people to a recession. I mean, 4 years from now, If the inflation's 8% a year and you're getting an average rate of what?
2.
Well, it's no. It would be, what's 14% divided by 4 is what? It's like 3 point something, right?
Yeah, 3 something. Yeah, 3.5, I think.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, if you don't have a COLA on top of that, what did you just do to your people? And what's the matter with you? Yeah, I for some reason, people believe all this crap about the CPI, and they. I mean, Kevin, all you have to do is look back 10, 15 years and look how what the CPI says and what stuff is done. I don't. Why are we this? And yet you listen to the TV all day long, and everybody gets this party line and just keeps talking about the same stuff. Oh, man, if we really, everybody should pull their money out of smaller banks and put them in bigger banks. Wait a minute. We had an asset run on a bank, and we...
Yeah, 2 weeks ago that was, nobody should be worried.
Yeah, and all of a sudden everybody wants their deposits out. So a bank, and we go through all the stuff about reserve requirements and demand deposits and all that other kind of crap we did the other day. But basically, does anybody really think that if everybody decides they don't like Jamie Dimon anymore, that he's going to... If there was a 10% run on Citigroup, that they've got the cash? I mean, the Fed would pour money in there till there's no money left in government to bail them out. So I guess you could count on that.
There's
piece.
Already no money left in government to bail them out.
I guess you could count.
We're coming up on that time bomb too.
Yeah. And anyway, say let's talk a little sports. The football is in. How far do you think this constant flying back and forth between teams and college teams are becoming like the NBA? They form a team every year. And how do you think that ever has a toll on Nebraska ticket sales, Notre Dame ticket sales? Or nobody cares? They just, whatever team they're watching today, everybody's on board with this new shtick.
Does it have any effect on pro ticket sales?
Well, I don't know. Baseball, it sure seems like it might. I mean, watching some of these games, there's nobody around.
Well, there's nobody around, you know, lately because it's just cold and rainy everywhere.
I watch a lot of NBA games that I never used to that aren't the Bulls. And I see a lot of places that not a lot of people are. I mean, I think it's affecting the – something's affecting the live crowd, whether it's money, whether it's something. But
Skip Bayless says Jimmy Buckets probably good to go for game three.
Okay.
All right. I'm comforted.
Well, I mean, I like the guy, and plus the fact that he's playing. I mean, Tibbs is the one who made the guy a player, and now he's on the other side. It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, well, I remember back when they drafted him, and I thought, you know, it was very late in the draft. I thought that's probably as good as they could have expected to get at that position because he was going to be a solid player no matter what. But he's turned in, obviously, into a big-time scorer, so that makes a big deal. Now, when you look at college, it is not the same. You know, you've seen my rant on this before. Yeah. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, you have all the transfers and all of that, but a lot of that is tied into the payroll. And right now, the payroll is driven by the name, image, and likeness collectives.
You know
what
who's
they
got
have
one
is,
of the number one NIL deals?
Who?
The gymnast from Louisiana.
Oh, she's smoking hot.
But, you know, you'd think that... women's gymnastics wouldn't get any attention, but she's got the highest NIL.
Well, and then you have the Cavender twins from Florida State basketball players, and those two young ladies are talking about going into pro wrestling.
Oh, God.
Seriously, I'm not joking on that. But here's the thing.
Actually, maybe I
you know,
like
my take on this is that there are two ways that they can go if they want to structure this system a little bit better. Given what they have today, one is just make the athletes employees of the university. Just do it because then you can have contracts and you can have somebody sign a 2 or 3 year contract, and it will at least resemble what we know in pro sports is you can see a lot of roster turnover, but by and large, when someone signs a long term deal, especially a star player, that star player is going to be there for the duration.
Kevin,
of the contract.
How far down the chain? We talk about all these people that are worth all this dough. Okay, but a regular school, a school that has, I don't know how many people totally have on scholarships, but let's say at Notre Dame the scholarship's worth, well, in real money it's probably worth 50 grand, the tuition's 70, but the average price people are paying is probably 50. All right, so it's worth 50.
Well, but the marginal cost of having an athlete there is much lower.
I'm just trying to be simple here. I'm trying to be, it's worth 50. Now, you've got... people obviously on the football side, maybe the basketball side, a few baseball, maybe a little bit of hockey, to where people are actually making money at this. Now, these networks, I don't know how much they pay for the hockey or for the women's softball or whatever, but they got to fill up the network somehow. Now, which kind of screws up the economics of it. But I'm going to say, out of all the people Notre Dame has on scholarship, how many of them are really worth more than 50 grand a year? And how many more worth a lot less?
I mean, well, what have we been saying for years? It's the tuition, room, and board is a good deal for the average schmuck. Other than the fact that, you do have to consider if you're going to make all the money, all the revenue that they have coming in, that you have to field a team. So you are reliant on...
Yeah.
On them to actually fill out the team, but what's happened is they've formed these collectives that they're paying everybody for name, image, and likeness rights, and then they have the right to use them as they see fit. And what they're really doing is it's an arm's length relationship with the school and the athletic department, where they are paying the athletes instead of that directly coming from the school itself, from the football program itself, for example. Well, to me, the arrangement really is an employment arrangement.
What I'm saying is, but just we only got a couple of minutes, Kevin. So let's keep it purely economic.
All right, look, let me cut to the chase on this. Here's what I'm saying.
The women's swimming team, they're not worth $50,000. I'm sorry. I mean, I'd love to have a swimming team. I'd like to see them go to the
Olympics. No, they exist on scholarship to justify the business model for the money, the revenue sports.
Right.
Because if you figure that football and basketball, and maybe women's basketball too, or, you know, a couple of other sports at some schools, are paying for the whole scholarship ensemble of the whole athletic department, that allows them to maintain this whole student athlete thing that they have going. And that's all that they exist for, is they're on scholarship to justify the others, because that keeps the payroll down. Now you have these name, image, and likeness collectives, and they are supplementing the quote scholarship side of the scholarship payroll.
But do what all the time when you write me. Split the name, image, and likeness out. And when I say that, you do this better than me. When the Supreme Court ruled on this, who knows what they were thinking, but when they ruled on this, they're talking about the girl that Greg was talking about, and they were talking about Dr. J's brother years ago, where he couldn't be an actor in the summer because they owned his image and likeness, or this girl can't be a model when she obviously has the ability to do so because they thought she was selling Georgia and not herself. So that was, to go that far, Kevin, there was no reason for these schools to prevent you from making money essentially in a side job during the summer or whatever it was. If you're a runway model and you happen to be a swimmer, they shouldn't stop you from being a runway model on a weekend. I mean, I think we all agree with that. But
and if you acquire some fame in the process, that makes you a more desirable runway model. If you're Arike Ogunbowale, who, you know, was able to go on Dancing with the Stars and, you know, things like that while she was playing, when you're doing that and your athletic fame makes you more desirable, that was what they tried to prevent for no good reason, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And that's what this is really all about. Okay, so that's all cool. Now we're setting up these things and calling it a name, image, and likeness payment, but it's really payment to be there and play.
It's a collective.
Play the sport.
It has nothing to do with you. You're just a big fat tackle, and now
you're just one of the many in the collective who are getting paid, and they may, you know, publish some photos of you or, you know, whatever it is they're going to do with it. Well, you know what? To me, the NCAA still has a rule against extra benefits for athletes.
They're not available
to the students in general, so we could kill that, or we can just make them employees, or we can figure out something else. But if you make those collectives go away, I think you make the whole system a lot more stable and a lot more what the intent of the court ruling
was. Well, the fact is they want to pay the tackle, and they don't want to pay him. Somebody else is going to pay him.
No. Yeah,
Kevin, they want to keep
them off the books because they don't want to deal with the employment issues that come with having these people be employees. So I'm going to turn it over to Russell and we can pick this up on Friday.
All right, S&P futures up 8, NASDAQ futures up 34. Is Russell already with us?
Yeah, he's here.
I'm here. I'm being quiet.
Is he wearing
staying out of the way? But I'm bringing experience with the dark web to the second hour.
Cool. Look forward to hearing that.
Are you not selling cardigans on the dark web, are you?
No, I'm not. But I'm very upset that a few of my websites got shut down yesterday.
Really?
I was making three people speechless at the same time. Go to break.
Oh God. We just went to break. I just gave what the futures are doing.
Oh, did you? Oh. Well then why is he still on here?
Well, he can stay and listen as long as he wants, as long as he doesn't
say
anything.
I'm getting the hell out of here.
All right. You two guys.
All right, I'm here.
I don't know if I can handle it. Can I handle it?
I'm still recovering.
All right, we're going to break.
I'm amazed I haven't gotten some trouble with the FCC yet. So there.
All right.
Yes, speechless again.
Yeah, I'm just...
And when we come back.
Yeah, I think we're going to go to break for a second. I need to process this. SP viewers up 8, NASA viewers up 34. Be right back.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, Give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Hello and welcome back to Action Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures up 36. Trying to come back a little bit from yesterday's pretty serious debacle early in the afternoon, but came back maybe a third of it yesterday. But we were, at one point, we were down pretty heavy. We were down 360 in the Dow, but we were over 500, I think, Russell. Nobody likes the idea that these banks are heading back south again. And I'm gonna say, Russell, that 3 years ago, if I would have said, this guy Russell, he's pretty damn smart. And by the way, he's a PhD at the time candidate. Now he's a PhD. And if I were to say, give me a 10-page paper on exactly what's going to happen if these interest rates come back up, and all the people that are going to be shocked at what happens and caught with their drawers down, I'm going to say you could have predicted every single thing that's happening today.
Oh, I don't think I really would have expected banks to be smarter with respect to the disconnect between what they were owning and what their liabilities were. I couldn't have predicted this.
Oh, you know what?
I seem to have more confidence in. I'm going to die naive, I guess.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you this. If the banks, if the big shots, whoever the big shots happen to be, you know, insurance companies and banks, if they didn't have the ability to lie to you financially, in other words, if Russell opens up an account at PTI or wherever the hell he is, and you buy a bond for 100 that's trading for 65, and you get the sheets from monthly or come online or whatever, PTI, you're going to say that this Russell guy who just put up $1 million for this bond, 2 years later it's trading 65, you got 650. And it's very emblazoned across your hide or your head or your behind or whatever that you just, right now today, you're down 350. Whose bright idea was that if you're big enough, like a bank or an insurance company, if you intend to hold it, that you don't have to recognize that you're down 350? Who's the moron who thought that up?
Oh, I think that's the accounting folks, and that's why I'm in finance.
No, I'm saying, but how did...
that allows people to, you know, that you're allowed to have or claim book value on a bunch of stuff that is worth a lot less than its book value.
Well, but I mean, this is, I mean, on banks, if a bank, and Kevin talked a little about this last week, because they're all different sizes, so he really couldn't give us an answer, but if you're First National Bank of Evergreen Park, and you go buy, you know, $1 million because you got all these deposits. You go buy $1 million, or even you have capital, okay? And what's good capital? You go buy a U.S. Treasury for $1 million. You're going to have to buy it through, I'm not going to say you're going to buy it through PTI, but you might buy it through RBC, You might buy it through Morgan or Goldman or somebody. Whoever it is, it's sitting there at $1 million that you just paid for it. And now it's trading 65 cents on the buck. Do they actually send you sheets out of Bernie, like a la Bernie Madoff, that shows it's still worth $1 million when it's not? I mean, or do they send it to you saying it's worth $650 and you go, I don't believe that, it's really still worth $1 million, and go on like nothing happened? One of those two things has to happen, and I can't imagine either one of them happening.
Well, they are allowed, if they believe they're not going to have to sell something, they can claim it at book value. And that's what was going on, was they didn't feel like, they had, and when I say they, I don't know what the how the capital allocation worked at First Republic, but I know how it worked at Silicon Valley Bank. And they, the rule was they had to claim market value on 4% of the securities portfolio they owned, and that way they weren't showing that the true value of the treasury bonds that they owned. And I think part of the problem, this kind of popped in my mind when I was teaching a graduate class last week. I was talking about treasury securities, and I was talking about them being risk-free. That's considered a good proxy for a risk-free rate. And then I'm sorry, my dog just did something funny on me here. Get off of me.
is that the Frenchie?
That's the Frenchie. She's nuts. The Frenchie just jumped on my head while I was trying to accounting.
Doesn't she know
dog
she's
is freaking nuts, man?
She's supposed to be dead. Doesn't she know that?
I know. Yeah, you're gonna live forever, aren't you? Yeah. I had a student like last Thursday when I was teaching. This incident happened, and I thought of you. We were talking about using standard deviation for risk, and I was talking about the standard deviation of treasury bond. And this one student said, well, why is there any standard deviation? They're risk free. And it occurred to me that risk free component is what, some of the people at the banks were thinking. Well, these are risk-free. We don't have to. We can hold them at book value. There's nothing to worry about here. We're going to hold them for the next 30 years. And if they were able to hold them for the next 30 years, they knew exactly what they would get cash flow-wise.
Well, why would anybody ever define risk-free means that the person who you borrowed the money from, or you lent the money to, meaning the federal government, is you're going to get your interest and you're going to get paid after 10 or 30 years. That's risk-free. It has nothing to do with what it's valued in the meantime.
The volatility.
I understand that. You understand that. Apparently, some regional banks did not understand that. I think that's where the and you and I and I feel like I remind you of this, but I remind myself of this a lot as well. We're very close to this stuff. We live and breathe this stuff. We understand. You joke around sometimes about me being a 1%er or whatever, but as far as financial knowledge goes, we are in the 1%. Well, and you would hope that people working at a regional bank would be in the 1% as well, but you got to start questioning that.
Well, they were buying it, and I'll bet if they didn't, Russell, as I mentioned earlier, if you were sitting on a board of a regional bank and you're putting money into 90-day T-bills and you're getting scata, as my grandmother used to say, somebody's going to say, hey, buddy, Mr. Russell, why don't we get in this 10 years? At least we're getting 1.5%, and we're getting nothing with this 9. What's the matter with you?
Was I supposed to bleep that one?
No.
No? Okay.
No. But, you guys brought that up this morning. I was listening in the first hour, and I heard you bring that up this morning. They just, they weren't thinking that they were going to have to sell all of that stuff. But at the same time, they were probably looking around and going, we're not making anything off of these deposits. What can we do?
Yeah.
Let's put them in risk-free treasury bonds, which aren't really risk-free.
Russell, so, could you, this is not sort of unprecedented that banks, that banks have balance sheet issues, but still can operate as banks. Would you, I know you can, would you give everybody a little bit of the history of the Japanese system and how this has gone on for really 25 years.
You know, and it's been, and that's, I don't know.
Where did you go?
System, as you bring it up, is they seem, you know, the quality of life over there seems to have been okay. Now, it might have to do with the demographics shrinking at the same time, and maybe zero interest rates make sense with shrinking demographics. But, you know, they've been able to kind of, they were able to sit around, you know, kind of I goof around for 20, 30 years, not really experience a whole lot of growth, but also, you know, not really experience a drop off in quality of life as well.
Well, you never had the investment, because a lot of what more of your risky investment, stuff that you're going to make money on, a new factory, a new oil well or something, you're going to have to pay somebody for that money. But what I was talking about in terms of this, for those, I mean, I really don't expect anybody to well, I expect a few people listening to this show to know, but the history of the Japanese banks, we are fighting here right now, for lack of a better term, tooth and nail, Russell, over people buying U.S. treasuries at ridiculously high prices because the rates were so low, and now are sort of gagging at them. But in this country, it's actually a small, well, it's not a small.
You know who's gagging more, though, are the European guys.
Oh, yeah, they're just not talking about
it. Oh, yeah.
That's why, I mean, when your alternatives are negative or zero.
Okay, but where I'm going with this, Greg, is that the only thing here that is considered good capital on the security side is the U.S. Treasuries. It used to be Fannie and Freddie preferred, and they all got clobbered on that too, right, Russell? But in Japan and in Europe, Greg, I don't know if you know that, you probably do. In Japan and in Europe, when I was over giving lectures there in 91, Dr. J and I was stunned, Russell, that stock in companies is considered good capital for a bank in Europe and in Japan. So if you bought, you know, shares in General Motors, that was considered good capital. It never has been here, or at least it hasn't been since the 29 crash. Whether it was before that or not, I don't know. Maybe that's a Russell question, but Russell's right here. But it hasn't been since then. You know, so we never had that problem. But the Japanese banks were loaded with this crap. When I say crap, I mean their stocks, when the Nikkei was at 35,000, let me see where it is now, over in Asia. But it went from 35,000 down to what, 9 or something? And now it's back to 29. But we're talking 25 years, 30 years?
I mean, No, it took forever and it's still not a full round trip.
But those banks were long all this stock at that price, and all of a sudden the stock market crashes. So every single bank really was, I won't say, they were absolutely, I'll use the term broke. They were insolvent on any level. Yet, in terms of the banking part, in terms of people going in and getting their auto loans and their credit cards and making their deposits and giving some money and writing a check against it, it really didn't affect them at all, right, Russell? Because there was never any run on the bank or anything like that, like we've had here in a couple places, which I never thought I'd use that term in the U.S. ever, other than in describing the Bailey's movie. But I mean, they managed to survive the term being zombie bank for how many years? Gradually making a little bit here, the market coming back, making a little bit there, chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. I'll bet they're all probably 30 years later, they're solvent, and they never went under, and nobody ever lost a dime on the consumer side. I'm not saying that's the way you want to do it, but it has happened before to a way more dramatic size than we're talking about here with U.S. Treasury. Some of those companies never came back. Right, at least the treasuries, you're going to get your money 10 years from now, right?
Right. So, but, I mean, one of the things that they did over there to keep things running, we have our central bank purchasing bonds and all kinds of bonds. Their central bank was buying securities as well. There were some ETFs that their central bank was the biggest holder of.
Are you sure we haven't?
I don't think in the ETF space we've been able to, but I feel like they've been able to do it in the fixed income space.
Well, didn't the
you wouldn't expect our bank, you know, our central bank to buy stocks to boost the stock market unless they were allowing, or they were, or banks were allowed to use those stocks in the way that the Japanese banks were able to use stocks.
They owned.
I can understand why Japanese banks would, or the central bank would repurchase the stocks or try to boost the stock market when it's going to have a positive impact on banks' balance sheets. You know, we did the same thing with our central bank here, but because the stocks aren't being used as the same kind of collateral as they are in other parts of the world, they weren't bumping. You know, they weren't loading up on stocks.
Well, clearly, Russell,
they were in a roundabout way, because when they buy bonds and then there's more cash in the system, it goes into the stock market.
They never. Anytime you don't. Well, we did this a couple times in the COVID, but it turned out to be a pimple on the ass of an elephant. They sent everybody a check for like $1,000. And they did the PPP. I think, Russell, when I went back and checked, if you look at the gross number, and this is unfair, look at the gross number of all the trillion-dollar bills that they came out with for COVID, and even the incredible amount of money people got in these PPP stuff, and most people would say some did deserve, whatever. That's the way the law was written.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, here's the unfair part, is I think some of the money that was a portion never actually got spent. But if you look at the gross numbers of how much these, was it two or three bills contained, and you looked at all the checks that came to the people, and you looked at the whole PPP, which smaller businesses got, it was only 25 to 30% of the total. So all the rest went to bigger places, you know, the United Airlines. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about is the Japanese, aren't you the one who told me at one point they owned 60% of like five or six of the ETFs, which were all stocks? They owned an incredible percentage of the stock market in Japan, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I don't remember if I'm the original source on it or we've talked about it, but I know we've definitely talked about it. Yeah, and that's because of the way that collateral shows up over there relative to how collateral shows up on bank balance sheets over here.
But here, I think you're right. It almost doesn't matter. That if you pour money into the system and you buy bonds and you run the price of the bonds up, then the money is now in the system, that somebody's going to take the money and buy stocks. It's not, you're absolutely.
Oh, yeah, especially when you're getting no yield whatsoever anywhere else.
Right.
Am I right to say in the 20s, stocks were allowed as collateral and broker-dealers were allowed to be in charge of how much they loaned?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah, yeah. So, and it wasn't just banks. It was like the guy that you maybe buy your morning paper from. You could also trade stocks on leverage with those guys in the morning.
So if the margin requirement now is 25%, that's
well, Greg. One thing though, your margin might have been less, your initial margin.
Oh yeah.
But the bad part was, it was very much like Greg is into. Greg trades a lot of commodities, and I guess we should. If I'm going to say this, I better give a little lesson on this. One of the things that came out, was it the 32 Act or Federal Reserve? The idea of the difference between initial margin and maintenance margin came up after the 29 crash, right? Right, Russell?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What I'm saying is if you were to buy, I'll pick IBM. Why do I always pick IBM? Let's trade 125. All right, so if you want to buy 1,000 shares of IBM at PTI, Merrill Lynch, you name it, that's 125 grand. You would have to send us a check for 62.5. You get to borrow initially 50%. And Greg is absolutely correct. It used to be less than that. And it's less than that on the futures side for the margins. However, if IBM drops $5 today, the people at PTI do not have to call you and say, send us some more dough. Because the maintenance margin is 30%. So until I...
What I was trying to get at was maybe that limit should be the amount you're able to consider as good collateral. So like if we're allowed to put, or if 25% is the limit or 50% is the limit, that should be allowed as good capital also, because the law dictates that you can borrow on it, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's the point. We don't, I mean, what Greg is suggesting is, why can't a bank buy stock and then have, but only be able to use a portion of it for its collateral? Well, then you run to the point where, well, who says that IBM is not going to go out of business? Then it's just a question of degree or when it's going to happen. You know what I'm saying?
And then what ends up happening is you know, if the stock market comes under pressure and depositors start to worry about, you know, IBM being used as collateral, if one of the banks they're at, they start to pull the money from that bank, and then the shares of IBM get sold, and it's, you know, it's the same kind of waterfall effect that didn't necessarily happen due to market activity, but the same sort of situation that we had with the Treasury bonds, you know, losing a lot of value because interest rates went up.
But Russell, why did we? Yep.
That would make it worse.
How much of this would have been, if any? Because I'm not, you know, where's my old professor at Notre Dame? When I had money in banking on the graduate level, how much would this would have been different? Because I'm trying to get a roundabout way. Is it almost, if you have enough of a reserve requirement on the deposits, and how much you can loan, the bank capital almost doesn't matter. I mean, you shouldn't really ever get into the bank capital. But now, how much of this is that the reserve requirement is zero? It's caused some of it. But I don't think banks are that loaned out either, though. I mean, banks...
No, they're not that loaned out. And that's the problem right there, is they're not loaned out. They're putting money in, and I'm doing air quotes, which I always hate, but I'm doing, in risk-free treasury securities that do change in price. And that's what they're doing instead of loaning money out for me to go buy a new car or something.
But
that's what they're doing. They're not doing what banks are supposed to do, which is taking our deposits, maybe paying me a couple of percent on a savings account and turn around and try to and get somebody to pay them 4% on a loan to buy a car or something and make money off of that spread. But I don't know, that's what they're normally supposed to do, but instead they put money into treasury securities that paid them a higher interest rate than they were paying out, and they probably felt safer about it, when in reality, because of market forces, that's not safer than loaning out to individuals.
Well, if you thought you were never going to have to pay interest again to a depositor, I guess 1.5% is not
bad. That would help too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny.
And the lack of realization that, and I even did this. I had money set aside for my oldest, who's going to college, and like for her spending money and stuff. And I put it in, I looked at it in a savings account, and it was getting like 1%. And I'm like, I don't need that money till August. So I bought a 6-month CD and got a little under, I did it a few weeks ago, so it was at lower rate. But I got a little under 4%.
Well, all of a sudden
is cash that is come out of one bank and gone into a certificate of deposit and been locked up for 6 months.
So, you know, you could have come to PTI and we'd have got you 5.1 at the treasury.
I know you told me that after I talked to you about this.
Yes.
But still, you know, that is creating a situation where banks either need to start paying interest or coming up with ways to earn more interest on the capital they have right now. And I don't know about you, but and I asked one of my graduate classes this last week. I seem to get two or three tap your home equity letters a week right now from banks trying to lend me money.
Oh yeah.
I'm seeing a big tick up in it, and I asked my grown-up class, both of them, and I got a lot of I'm seeing a lot more of those things in the mail. So the banks are trying to figure out a way to maybe get away from owning treasury securities, and I don't know if it's a reaction to what happened at Silicon Valley Bank or not, but they deviated from their traditional business, and whenever a company deviates away from their traditional business, there's excess risk there.
Well, you know, weird about this, Russell, is one of the classes that I took at Notre Dame, and this guy, he was a character, Croteau, he was actually the only full economics professor at Notre Dame at the time, this old duck, and he wrote a book called The Economics of the Credit Union, and it's still in print. He's got to be long dead, the class was on credit unions, and my stepfather, in those days, there were a lot of credit unions around, a lot of churches had them. Well, St. John Fisher, where I went to grammar school, that parish. I mean, if you're on the south side, it's not a church. It's a geographical area, right, Russell? That square mile was St. John Fisher. And they had a credit union. And he and this and another friend of mine's dad, Fred Marabito, ran the credit union. And they had some guy with nothing better to do. They paid him, like, God knows, next to nothing to sit up there on Monday and Wednesday nights, a little credit union office in the basement of the church or the rectory. And the guy's name was Barney something something. Barney, he was not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he had nothing better to do. He was retired, so he'd go up there. And the whole thing was manual. Greg, you wouldn't even believe. They had the big book, and everybody's account was in there. And when you went in there, they turned a page to your account, and if you had like $300 in there, it was, I think they paid 3% or something. Well, somewhere, somebody, Barney probably, had gone through, and if you had $300, they calculated the 3% divided by 12, you know, and that was, and then they would add it to your thing in there. So then you bring your passbook in, and not only would you give them another $50, they'd add the 48 cents interest from the month before and onto your passbook. So it was like, so you got $50 and 48. So I said to Barney, I wasn't even in high school.
How many people did they do this for?
Many hundreds.
Yeah.
The bank used to have a huge stack of that stuff, right? In the day, Russell, before there were computers, it was all done manually. But anyway, so I said to Barney, how are things going? He goes, well, you know, we're paying you 3%. And I go, yeah. He goes, we better get another couple of loans or we're not going to be able to pay the 3%. But 3% was the going rate. Savings and loans paid that. Credit unions paid that. So it's incumbent upon the bank or the credit union to find loans, because, you know, there is demand for money, to find good loans that are you know, people are paying you 6%, and you're only losing on one of 100 of them, or one or 200 instead of one of four, and you're supposed to, you've got to go get your revenue. That's what I don't think people really, the liability.
Yeah, and the easiest way to go get the revenue is buy a treasury bond and get the coupon payments off of it,
or give it to the Fed overnight.
And look at this. We're paying 2% and our treasury bond is giving us 3.5%. We're in great shape. Let's go play golf.
Yeah, well, but the problem comes if you're if all of a sudden people are now demanding really 2.5%. If there's people saying, if you want my money to stay in this bank, you better start paying me 2.5%.
Something. Yeah.
And they're saying, wait a minute, we're only getting 1.5%. Well, that's a problem. Right? I mean, futures up 10. NASDAQ futures up 39. Go to a short break. Russell will be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
There's something happening here.
Loading up back Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 10. NASDAQ Futures up 35. Greg, when you're done with traffic, weather, sports, see if you can chase this one down. Russia claims Ukraine attempted to attack on the Kremlin with drones. Says Putin wasn't in. Isn't it a long way from Ukraine to Moscow with a drone? I just, anyway.
Yeah, long way.
I think it's a long way. So let's do,
let's do some traffic.
Yeah, we'll get rid of this, and then we got a bunch of other stuff. Axe Russell. Dow's up 46. So S&P futures are up 9. They've been like this pretty much all morning, trying to come back a little bit on yesterday's rotten day. DAX up 130.8%. FTSE up 29.4%. CAC around up 48.6. So moderately bullish over in Europe. Asia, and we've got the Chinese mainland still closed from last Friday. Hang Seng is up, down 234, 19,699. And we've got the Nikkei up 34, the 29,158. It's only 0.1%. It's almost nothing. Yesterday, Dow was down 367, S&P down 48, but that doesn't really tell the tale because the Dow was down almost 500 and S&P was down 75, so we actually came back for that lousy result. Bonds, 10-year down 4 basis points, 3.40. The Bund unchanged, 2.24. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.42. This is a big move here, though. Oil down 204 to 69.62. That's almost 3%. Brent down $2, 73.32. Natural gas down 4 cents, 217. We've got gold. Now it's down $1.90. It was up a little earlier, but it was still over 2,000, 2,021. Silver down 13 cents, 25.48. Copper down a penny, 384. We've got Bitcoin down 262, 28,515. And we've got the U.S. dollar is down again with the pound back over almost to 125, 1.2497. So let's call it 125. And the euro back over 110, 1.1038. So again, the dollar has been shrinking a little bit lately, and it's kind of showed the gold prices and the oil prices. We have for us Trevi Weather Sports.
Morning, everyone. 7:35 a.m., 42 degrees now with a high of 55. Mostly cloudy, about 66 on the forecast for Chicago, or 55 today in Chicago. 66 in Phoenix, headed to about 90. Traffic, we've got the inbound Kennedy, 290 to the Jane Byrne is 43 minutes now. To Montrose in Ohio is about 24 minutes. Inbound Edens, Deerfield to 290 and Jane Byrne Interchange, 37 minutes now. Outbound to Deerfield Road, 36 minutes.
I'd turn back if I were you.
The Eisenhower is Thorndale to the Interchange, 55 minutes now. And outbound to Thorndale is 34 minutes. The Ryan inbound is 29 minutes, outbound is 12 minutes, so that's not that bad. 95th. Inbound 57 is 53 minutes now, so I-90 290 to the interchange is 53 minutes. Inbound Stevenson is 48 minutes from 294 to Dan Ryan. Bishop Ford is 64 minutes in, so if you're coming to the loop from I-80 and 290, that's going to be more than an hour now. Same thing with the I-80 94 Kingery.
Well, no wonder the Ryan's easy going out. Nobody can get here to go out.
Yep. Everything is getting worse also, so keep that in mind. Sports, we've got the NBA Heat beat the Knicks. Knicks beat the Heat, excuse me. That's tied 1-1. And Jimmy Buckets is coming back next game, according to Skip Bayless. So that's Saturday, game 3. Warriors lost to the Lakers. That series is LA 1-0. NHL, the Leafs beat Florida. That is 1-0. Panthers beat the Leafs, excuse me. So Panthers beat the Leafs 4-2. Florida leads that 1-0. Kraken beat the Stars in overtime 5-4. Seattle.
So both number one seeds in hockey are out too.
Yeah.
Bruins and the Avalanche, right?
Yeah, the Colorado got beat, so oh well.
Oh well.
Maybe next season. Cubs lost at Washington 1-4. Tonight's game is at 6:05. Stroman versus Irvin. Sox beat the Twins 3-2 in the 10th yesterday, and their game starts tonight at 6:10. And Arizona lost at Texas 4-6. And tonight their game is, or today their game starts at 1:05 Central. That's all I got, Chief.
You know, I have a Everybody knows, well, everybody accuses me, Russell, of being a serious Luddite on certain subjects, and they're probably right. One of them is not having a regular ticket for a baseball game. And I'm going to...
Oh, it bugs me, too.
But I'm going to go out there on a limb and say one of the reasons why you have these nights where there is nobody there, when I say nobody, where you get, you know, the place is 10% full like Washington was the other night, is the inability of somebody like me who may have four tickets to a Cub game, but say Greg and I are going to go. I talk Greg into suffering with me on a cold night. We could bring the other two tickets with us, and we could sell them for somebody to half price outside the place. Or I didn't have to pay Major League Baseball to transfer. I didn't have to give the guy my phone number. I didn't have to do anything like that.
Each ticket's worth a couple of beers, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying the difficulty of just doing that, or you're driving to the park with the four tickets and your buddy calls up and says, you know, my kid's sick, I can't make it, of selling the other ticket. I don't want to give somebody my number and go through the system. Don't I have to pay Major League Baseball to flip it to somebody? Is it like a 10% fee or something? Or I guess he could come in with me, and I could just use my phone. Mm-hmm. But it's a hassle. I think one of the reasons why on these nights like this there's nobody there is it's difficult to transfer the ticket over. Just saying. Hey,
you don't think it's because people are more worried about their money and going to those baseball games?
That too. I'm saying it all adds up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a combination of it. But I do. Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, you don't have somebody walking around on the trading floor that, you know, say, anybody want to go to the Cub game tonight? I've got two extra tickets.
Yeah.
And it's just not happening the same way. You know, people are more likely to eat their tickets.
Yeah.
Or they, you know, they can put them back up for resale through the Cubs, but where they'll take, you know, they'll take something from you to do that on your behalf. But people aren't turning around and buying those tickets through the, you know, buying them to get them on their phone through the Cubs as well. But yeah, I think, yeah, the paper ticket thing may, you know, you can't just happen to be walking by Wrigley and all of a sudden it's two innings in and there's somebody trying to get rid of a couple of tickets for $5 a pop. That's not happening
anymore.
Well,
one summer I went
I can see that.
One summer I went to like seven different ballparks. I had, you know, some time and I took a long weekend. I was doing a show, but I'd leave on Friday. I did Pittsburgh on Friday night, and then I did Toronto on Saturday night. I came home on a Sunday, that kind of thing. And I went to Cleveland and a few others. I never even dreamed of needing a friggin' ticket. I just walked up an hour before the game,
yeah.
And plus, I always found somebody who's a buddy or whatever couldn't make it, and sat next to them and ended up talking to somebody really nice for the whole game.
Yeah.
Whatever business they were in. But hey, I got a question for you. And I don't want to get, as we know, I try to stay not too politically on the show, but boy, oh boy. This has been an interesting week for Stocks and Jacks a little bit, Russell, because Nancy came out on Monday. I don't know if you ever listened, but she's our mortgage lady. Very, very bright.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me about this, and good thing Jan Flanagan was here, because and she jumped me big time, talked about this new rule that when you go to get a mortgage now, the people who have the higher credit scores are essentially subsidizing the people with the lower credit scores. And I it was disbelief. Like, what are you talking about? And Jan said, no, she was right. And Nancy went through it and was explaining it. And I absolutely was so befuddled by it, Russell, I was almost tongue-tied for me. Imagine that. And sure enough, I'm listening to CNBC. Monday afternoon, that's all they talked about. And now I get a call from my buddies over in the mortgage. They service mortgages. Their company buys distressed loans and properties and so forth. And these guys, that's all they do all day, is either help people with their mortgages if they can be helped, or try to get them out if they can't because they're not paying. So the guy says to me, Monday night, we have a cocktail. I go, you got to look into this. So Tuesday, I start getting texts from him going, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And the guy's sending me an article. Who even dreams up stuff like this, Russell? And I mean, I really hope, boy, much as I've been a Democrat most of my life, even though I voted for just as many Republicans, I really hope that the Republican Party can find somebody normal to run that's somewhat moderate so I can vote for him. Because where this other side's going with all this stuff, I have no idea. But then I sure as hell can't go back to Trump, and his DeSantis is starting to look like somebody from the, you know, some God knows what dictatorial party as well. But I mean, is there anybody in the middle we're going to get here that has some common sense? I mean, why would anybody even dream for a second that some poor schlub with a 750 credit score somehow or another has to subsidize somebody with 650? Why would anybody even think of that?
Well, I can tell you why they would think of it. Not that why they would think it makes sense, but why they would think of it. I think they thought it would be kind of a sneaky way to, redistribute wealth. There's no other way to put that. To get more people in houses and, you know, have somebody with a high credit score effectively pay part of the mortgage for somebody that has a really low mortgage.
But there's not a one-to-one correlation between wealth and credit score. Credit score is whether
you're... No, there's not. There absolutely isn't. And you know, if you're, you know what, do you think anybody, I'm not going to say anybody, do you think Joe Biden has ever known what his credit score is or what it means? And I'm not talking about, you know, doddering Joe Biden who doesn't know what day of the week it is right now. But, you know, through his whole life being nothing but a government service and
I think his,
being in government and never having to worry about money.
In his particular case, I think his wife has written out every single check. I don't think he has a clue.
Probably doesn't. You know, and that goes for, you know, Trump as well, although his credit score would be kind of interesting, wouldn't it? most of those guys. And, you know, I'm fixated on my credit score. I really am. I want to keep it at a decent level. I've always, once I've been able to get myself out of all kinds of school debt and everything else, I've never wanted to dig myself back into that hole. And, you know, I find it kind of funny that, you know, trying to be somewhat conservative with my own cash and not rack up too much in debt and at the same time live a decent life. I'm now, if I decide to go buy a new place, I'm going to suffer because of that.
But I mean, even if people who, if you thought you wanted to give money to people, I'm not so sure it's the guy making 50 grand a year and pays his everything on time doesn't have an 800 credit score, and a guy making 200 a year that just pays when he feels like it has got a 650 credit score. Why should guy A subsidize guy B?
No, he shouldn't. He absolutely shouldn't. Yeah, and I do. You know, I do get, and this is just another form of trying to create, kind of a welfare type system, but doing it in somewhat of a stealth way.
But something's changed here, Russell, and I here you can be my psychologist. Something has changed. Me being, I would say, and I'm not afraid to admit it. My conservative friends, I don't really give a crap. In a lot of ways, I'm very, very liberal. Money wise, you know, I'm not, because the stuff adds up, and if it doesn't add up one day, it'll add up the next day, and somebody's going to get hurt between the two, and it's always the same people that get hurt. So, money wise, I'm always conservative, but I was always very liberal in the sense that if there's an area that the education wasn't so good, I'm willing to spend a lot of money, or whatever it takes to have the high schools open at night. They have job training programs. Matter of fact, for a while after college, Kevin's older brother Tim, who was my roommate, that's how Kevin and I got to know each other so well. His older brother Tim and I were roommates for 3 years. And Tim became a social worker, and he said that they would constantly be in these bad neighborhoods, and they would find people who were willing to go into these job training things, and sometimes they got to the end and actually did very well, and there was never a job, or sometimes was a job, but there was always, in my mind, there was everything I would try to do, and people around me tried to do, was to help people get into, I won't say the American dream, but the American system. That if you didn't have the training, if you didn't have this, the education, we're going to try and get you the education, get you the training, or help you do that to where at the end of the day, you've got a job, you're self-sufficient, you can have a family, then you can pay for the kids to go to school. I mean, Kevin, right now, that's his life, too. I mean, Kevin wants to take these guys in the junior colleges or whatever, that group of people, blue-collar people, and he wants to teach a course where the guy's making $12 an hour. When he's done with Kevin's curriculum, he's making 18.
When you guys are talking about the redistribution, just going over regular taxes, I think the top 1% pays something like 20% of the taxes.
They have, 80% of the income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and top 25% pays around more than three-quarters.
Okay, but don't... We'll get into that for a second.
So it's nothing new in terms of redistribution. It's just
all right. But
it's and just Chief, you said what has changed? Well, I think what has changed is they're running out of ways to, in a sneaky way, redistribute wealth.
Well, I guess what
they thought, I'll guarantee they thought that they would just announce this thing and everybody would say, okay, that sounds good, and move on. I don't think they expected there to be some sort of an uproar around this one.
Well, I guess my question is, and it takes me so long to preamble this stuff. I'm getting like George Stigler, except he has a Nobel Prize and I don't. The preamble is now it seems to me a lot of the programs are not designed to do that. It's where at the end of the day, you're spitting out somebody who's going to be self-sufficient, is going to have a job, and you're not going to have to worry about him or her ever again. Now it's almost a permanency to it, where the programs are designed where this person is never going to have a job. They're always going to be the unwed mother with the four kids from four different people or whatever it is, and they're never going to have a job. It's just a question of constantly throwing money at to me that's a totally different animal than helping somebody to get to the point where they are self-sufficient. Am I making myself some? Now, the idea of, in other words, I don't want this permanent underclass. I want the underclass up and on their own. And that's not where the goals are now, it doesn't appear to me.
There's no proving you're wrong on this one. You're absolutely, you're dead right on. And then it's when you say, permanent underclass, that kind of starts to trigger the conspiracy stuff in my mind. Where, is this being done by design? And you'd like to think that it's not being done by design, but you like to think, and you say this an awful lot, you like to think the powers that be that are coming up with these ideas, aren't completely stupid. But then, it's either they're stupid or they've got really terrible motivations behind some of these things.
Well, Karen like, Reeves ran for the representative spot. I don't know if you happened to listen to either one of the interviews with her, Russell, but I was so taken by this lady in a sense that she how hard she worked. But when she talked about the areas where she was in these job training programs, all she talked about was people that at the end ended up with a good job.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't grabbing money for somebody could stay home and got a bigger check. It was all she talked about was bringing people. It wasn't just an economic thing; it's a psychological thing. I now am on my own. I don't need anybody's help anymore. By the way, I might get to the point where I can help somebody else. That's once that stops being the goal, I have a real problem with this.
And I don't feel like that's it might be a stated goal in some situations, but. I don't think that seems to be the goal of our system, or if that's the goal of our system is not set up to hit that goal anymore.
No, it sure isn't. Hey, I wanted I don't know if you listen to again, in case one of your students are listening, you can back off of this one if you want. But I didn't even, as you know, I think I might have mentioned it to you a couple times, maybe just when I was talking and not even on the air, that every single time that one of these crises comes up, starting with, Resolution Trust in the 80s and Volcker and all this stuff, every single time it seems like the bigger just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And right now I'm absolutely of the belief that Volcker, in addition to some of the good stuff he did, put the savings and loans out of business on purpose. He could have let up earlier. He could have saved half of them. He wasn't going to save all of them. But he put the whole industry really out of business. And I don't think he had to do that. and who was a beneficiary at the banks. And I was at the University of Chicago before that, and there were people there that were absolutely convinced that this savings and loan stuff, you know, there's a place in a neighborhood and people put their money up, and how it should be this vast system of sharing risk countrywide and stuff. There were people who just absolutely couldn't stand that industry and were writing theoretical things about. They forgot all about the people who were writing the mortgages, knew the neighborhood, knew the houses, knew the people. They totally dispensed with all that, you know. But I'm saying is, but Hal the other day comes in, and he's more of a libertarian economist than you are. He's from the, what's the school? Not the Czechoslovakian, is it the Austrian school? Yeah, Austrian school. But he came in the other day, and out of the blue, without me even prompting him, he says, you know, when this happened in 2008, we had X number of banks. When we came out, we had way less. Now it is, he goes, every time there's one of these sort of crises, even the total manufactured crises of Greenspan going to 1% when he had no business doing it, and then came and then talked about irrational exuberance and ran the rates back up. He goes, we lost, you know, 500 banks. Then he goes, I have to believe that this is totally orchestrated. Every time we do this, it's always the Fed doing the same thing, lowering rates down to where they're not sustainable, and on the way back up, some people get caught. It's always the small banks get caught, and always the big banks end up getting bigger. He goes, He goes, I can't be the only person who realizes there's a pattern to this. It's caused by the Fed. The fix causes less banks. He goes, what are we doing here? Am I the only one who smells a rat? And I'm sitting there going, I almost said, hell, you sound just like me. Am I wearing off on you or what?
Well, and again, I don't know if it, you know, I don't know if they're thinking that far ahead. You know that, and what happened to these regional banks really was them shooting themselves in the foot.
But they all did.
Bigger banks have been able to benefit from it. So I don't know necessarily if it's, you know, by design that, you know, they're hoping some regional banks will go under.
Wait,
so
wait,
maybe
you don't think that, you don't think that J.P. Morgan has a vault full of these bonds?
Oh, I'm sure they do, but they also don't have, I'll bet you they don't have as a percentage of their deposits, a vault full of those bonds that's, you know, all of their deposits, like some of these regional banks did. You know, they've got to be prepared for a little bit more in outflows than
I think
4%.
They shoved their money to the Fed. They got their interest in the Fed overnight. They were able to do that where the smaller ones probably weren't. They didn't have to buy them as much. Because they were able to go. Remember I mentioned to you that my Fed buddy told me at one point 2 years ago that M0 would become bigger than M1, the money back at the Fed overnight that the Fed was paying interest on. So I think that's. I don't think that the J.P. Morgans of the world, they just were able to go to the Fed directly and get the interest overnight. They didn't actually have to buy the
paper. Right. And they're making less in interest, but the other thing is the really large banks have a whole lot of other profit centers. They have all kinds of, my freaking concussion, dude. I totally lost my train of thought there. You're going to have to help me.
Maybe you've got a advance.
Sorry.
What you're saying is they're also in banking or in investment.
They're sales and trading.
Yeah, they're sales and
They've got that's where I was going. I apologize. I'm sorry.
But they're also.
They've got a whole lot of other profit centers other than just taking deposits and doing a few other things. You know, I doubt that Silicon Valley Bank had a whole lot of had a consistent fee based income stream that they could rely upon, whereas the very large banks have multiple lines, and beyond that, they're also making money trading.
Well, plus they're what percentage of the credit cards does like Citi have?
Exactly. Yeah, I doubt Silicon Valley Bank was making a whole ton off their credit cards either.
What?
Every single credit card that I have, and I've got four of them. You know, one's Amex, and the other three are either Chase or Citi.
Okay, because if you went over to Lakeside and got a credit card. Who's gonna manage that? It's gonna go through somebody, right? But I have a.
I would assume so. They may lay that off on somebody else immediately.
Well, you know, I have get a load of this. I have a, of all things, I have a Bass Pro Shop credit card.
Cool.
Well, three reasons. One is,
are you culturally appropriating my southernness?
No, actually,
You have no idea how mad it makes me when I see like Wall Street bros wearing Bass Pro Shot hats. When I grew up in Tennessee, and that's my culture.
Oh God! Well, actually, I blame this one on Kevin. I blame this one on liking to get some free stuff, and I blame it on being a sucker for a very attractive and very pleasant young lady.
Oh, I'm going to put that one at number one for you. But go ahead.
So I walk in, and some guy says, "Hey, we got this special on credit cards today, and you get three of these really nice prizes: a mug and something else." And I go, "Ah, that's okay." But so I buy some stuff, and I go over to the, because there was one right down by Ogden Dunes. So I stop in there once in a while just to see the stuff that's in there, because it's fascinating the stuff that's in there. So I get some stuff. So of course, this very attractive young lady says, "You know, you should be getting one of our credit cards." And I go, "All right." So I schlump over. And the reason why I did this is Kevin says, if you're going to buy stuff online, you should have a credit card that only has like a $1,000 limit on it. So no matter what happens, you only get stuck for $1,000. And I had two credit cards. One I've got, you know, whatever, my limit's 20 or something. American Express is infinite, right? And I don't know what the other one is like another 20. So I'm thinking, I should listen to Kevin once in a while. He actually knows what he's talking about. So I'm going to tell this guy, I just want a $1,000 limit on this thing. Mm-hmm. And so I go over there, and he says, "Well, which three prizes do you want?" I grab these three real nice things. And of course, the guy goes, "Oh, we just looked at your credit score. The minimum you can have, sir, is like 8. And I go, "I don't want 8. I want 1. And maybe you could call the people when you get home and argue with them and get driving out of 7, because they're so happy they got a client that out of the chute gets 8 without even asking. It's exactly what I didn't want. So then as I get back to Audrey's, and her three friends snap up the three prizes. So now I got a credit card I don't want. And you got
no swag.
And I got no swag. just what happens.
But you were ahead of the time, because you know now like Bass Pro Shops is like, you know, like the new cool thing.
Well, that one is.
You were cool, but you're always cool before cool becomes cool.
Well, but now that's a Capital One card. I had no idea when I signed up for that. So Capital One does their servicing. So I guess my question is, I mean, does anybody, even like Lakeside Bank, do they do their own servicing, or are there only like three or four places do the servicing?
I'll bet you that they outsource that.
Probably.
I don't have a credit card with a smaller bank, but I know when I lived down in Memphis and I had one through First Tennessee, that it was actually being serviced through somewhere else. I can't remember where, but I just remember reading through the stuff.
If PTI decides to issue a credit card, how big mm-hmm. do you have to be? Do you have to be like 10,000 of them before it's worth it to you, or can you do 200? I mean, Notre Dame used to have a credit card, their credit union.
I'll bet you, after saying that out loud right now, that you hear from one of the large banks that would love to do an affinity card with Stocks and Jocks credit cards.
Really?
RBC?
Maybe. Oh, I'm sure they'll be over that, and they'll be on top of you in a heartbeat.
Well, I'll have to put your picture on there or something.
You do not want a picture of me on your credit card, especially after you haven't seen my mangled face yet. I saw somebody I hadn't seen in like 6 months, and they said, "Oh my God!"
Well, you're not 100% yet.
I don't think I'm ever going to be 100%. I think I'm stuck like this.
Did you actually break bones?
You know what? I'm going to come visit you, and you can take a look.
Oh God! I always thought you just make sure you got the glasses and the pipe and the sweater.
Yeah, as long as I have on the same outfit, I'm sort of recognizable.
Oh, God. But, well, take care of yourself.
And my phone still recognizes my face when I log in, so it's not that bad.
All right, what's the Fed going to do? I'm going to say a quarter point and stop.
Quarter point and plan no further action for the foreseeable future.
We're buying the same
in
page?
In the statement. To buy stocks, that's what I want to see in the statement.
All right, so when have the two of us ever been wrong?
Three times a day.
Take care of yourself, buddy. Say hello to the little Frenchie for me. SP Futures up 4, NASDAQ Futures up 16. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. Cairo Med.
back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.